Now take a couple of deep breaths, settle in, relax. And then just breathing normally. Just become aware of whatever it happens to be happening within you, around you. And you maybe imagine that what's happening comes like waves. Waves of sounds of my voice. Sensations in the body, thoughts, feelings. They come and go like the waves in the ocean. Just allow yourself to be still in the midst of whatever way you're experiencing yourself now. Allowing whatever is there to be there, but noticing it, knowing what it is. If you're caught up in thoughts or in the feelings or emotions or the sounds around you or itches or sensations, allow them to be and use you with a still, present awareness in the midst of it. And then within your experience, become aware of your breathing. Feel the rising of the breath, the falling. Like waves washing up and down off the shore. Feel the coming of the inhalation, the going of the exhalation. Other sensations, sounds, thoughts arise. Allow them to come like waves. Acknowledge them, and then return to the breathing. Letting your awareness float or rest on the waves of breath. If some other experience besides the breath becomes predominant, acknowledge it, name it, sense it and be with it, and let it go, let it pass, without being concerned how long it takes for it to pass. Some experiences pass quickly, some pass slowly. Just allow things to be the way they are. Acknowledge. Be aware. Clearly know. Oh, this is happening now. This is happening now. And this is happening now. When sensations in the body are strongest, let the sensations be your meditation and rest your attention on those sensations. When sounds are predominant, they become the meditation. When emotions or feelings are predominant, turn the knowing, let the knowing awareness fully be present for the emotions and feelings. Feeling them in the body. When thoughts are predominant, be aware, note the event of thinking. The content of the thoughts are not important. Is simply to notice the process of thinking happening. And if the thoughts are very strong, feel the energetics of them or feel the emotionality connected to them. Let all things be as they are. Let them come and go as they wish. You, in the midst of it, with a still knowing and awareness, resting in the breath, letting your awareness be at ease. Awareness itself, by itself, never judges, never criticizes. Awareness by itself doesn't grasp or hold on to anything. Awareness is like a great open field or space through which whatever it's aware of, the objects come and go. Allow your breath to come and go through your awareness, knowing this is the in-breath, this is the out-breath. Let your physical sensations be as they are in the midst of the great field of awareness, knowing, oh, this is an itch. This is a tightness. Let feelings and emotions exist as they are in the great open space of knowing, oh, this is anger. This is joy. This is sadness. This is calm. And then finally, you can also be aware of what your relationship is to what is happening. Is there a relationship of judging or evaluation? Is there pushing things away, or is there aversion or clinging, desire, expectation? Simply be aware of what's happening, aware of your relationship. What is your relationship right now with what's happening? Is it an absent relationship? You drifted away in thought? Or are you impatient or delighted or at ease? Judgmental? Aversive? Sometimes the instructions for doing mindfulness practice can seem very complicated because we talk about so much. We talk about being aware of the breath, of being sensations in the body, being aware of thoughts and feelings and emotions. And today I talked about being aware of the relationship we have, what's going on. And it seems like you can be very busy, kind of, well, what should I do next? And am I doing it right? And what is the relationship? The idea is that it's supposed to be very simple, the meditation. And one way of trying to get that across is I try to distinguish between a prescriptive understanding of the instructions and descriptive. Prescriptive is you prescribe something you're supposed to do. Descriptive is rather you describe what you're aware of. So I prefer to see the instructions as being descriptive rather than prescriptive. It's not supposed to be like this is what you're supposed to do and a checklist of things to do. But it's more the spirit of you set yourself down and perhaps if you can establish some kind of ease of awareness of body, of mind, and then become aware of your breathing very simply and directly. And then you become sensitive and you become aware of what arises. When you try to do that, what becomes your predominant experience? And the breath, the body, the sensations, the feelings, the thoughts, the relationship, all those are really the things that you, the territory, the stuff that you become aware of if you're to stay aware. Because if you're aware, that's what will appear. Sometimes your body will appear and you feel a strong sensation in your body. Sometimes an emotion will appear and you become aware of that. So it's more, the spirit is more of reception, of receiving, and being aware of what arises. And you just be there to be sensitive to it, rather than one of actually, you know, actively wondering what's next, and should it be the body next, or this, or am I doing it right, and a checklist kind of thing. But rather being at ease, and then allowing things to arise, and as when they arise, then you bring your careful attention to that. So it's actually very simple. Does that make sense? But now one of the things that we've become aware of is our relationship to what's happening, and that's often the place where we get stuck. Part of the premise of mindfulness practice is that all things are impermanent, in flux, and a lot of our suffering arises when we try to act in a way that's contrary to the impermanent nature of phenomena. We hold on to things, we grasp onto things, we try to push them away as if they're a problem. The ways in which we lock up, that kind of relationship to stuff tends to lock up the mind, the heart, the body. It tends to freeze or hold on to things. It's kind of like you're kind of like you're standing next to a river, and you take a bucket, and you take a bucket of water out of the river, and you point to the bucket and say, "This is the river." Or it's kind of like you take a Polaroid snapshot of something, and then you go around pointing to the Polaroid picture. And this is the reality, forgetting about everything else that's going on around you. In some way, some form or other, we do that to our life. Rather than staying present for the flow and the change of phenomena, we enter into a relationship that freezes something, holds on to something. And so learning what our relationship then is part of becoming freer, seeing what that relationship, where we're stuck, what's going on. And there's many ways. So, for example, this is an example that I often use is, you think that what you're supposed to be doing is watching your breath when you meditate. And what's going on is you have a knee pain. But you think, you know, that the knee pain is an intrusion on your meditation. Or a sound in the room is an intrusion on the meditation. So you have a relationship then of, this is an intrusion and this is unacceptable, I'll push this away. Or you're feeling, this is terrible, or I hate this, or I don't like this. That's forming a relationship with it, which is extra. And that in some ways freezing reality through that aversion. Rather, the spirit of mindfulness is, oh, it's just a sound. However, the relationship itself, we allow that to be there, if there's there. We want to just simply recognize it. Oh, I have a relationship of aversion. Oh, this is what's going on now. If we can recognize it, then we become freer. The idea of mindfulness is, and this is probably repeating myself, but there's a difference between thinking and knowing we're thinking. There's a difference between having a feeling and emotion and knowing we're having this feeling and having this emotion. The knowing itself is a very simple kind of very, very simple phenomenon. It's almost invisible. It has no texture, no color. Where do you point? Can you point to it, the knowing? Where is it? You know, kind of vaguely, some people would point to their head, but I don't even know if that's accurate enough. Where is your knowing? What color is your knowing? What shape is it? It's kind of like a very strange phenomena. It's not a feeling, it's not an emotion, it's not a physical sensation. It's, what is it, knowing itself? It's kind of translucent, transparent. It doesn't have any content in and of itself. I mean, it contains whatever comes into it, but it itself is kind of transparent, it's invisible. Because of that, we often overlook it. We don't give it much credence and value. We identify with, oh, my body, my body's well-being, my body's pain. We identify with our emotions, my good emotions, my bad emotions. We identify with our thoughts and ideas and stories about things. But the knowing that knows all that stuff is actually a very, very important aspect of our life. And the premise or the idea of mindfulness practice is we simply bring the knowing consistently to what's happening moment by moment. We bring awareness to the breath. The awareness itself is not the breath. We bring awareness to the breath. And we rest in that awareness, or we allow the breath to come to the awareness. And say, why do this? Well, in the moment, maybe it doesn't seem so special, but that's where our clarity and our wakefulness and our freedom will lie. And our not caught upness is found in the knowing. And to put together a continuity of knowing, continuity of awareness over time, allows the mind, the heart, the body, our life, to become freer and more flexible, more fluid. And it's a cumulative benefit that really takes hold in people's lives. In a moment, sometimes it can be very sharp and very dramatic, but really you'll see the benefits by just putting together over time, knowing, oh, this is happening, this is happening. Why should you recognize what's happening? Well, keep doing it. This is happening, this is happening. Resting in the present moment, being at ease in the present moment, noticing when something arises which takes you away from the ease of the present moment. So the relationship is important. When we start talking about our relationship to experience, we often then talk about what's called the five hindrances. And I'll mention them very briefly tonight. And then next Thursday is Thanksgiving, so we won't have a meeting. But the following Thursday, I'll be gone. But Brigitte, who's one of our senior students in our sitting group here who gives talks regularly enough, is going to give a talk on the five hindrances, and which is often, I asked her to do it because the sixth week of a five-week introductory course, but we just pretend it kind of keeps going. And the sixth week of the course, we talk about the hindrances. So if you want to kind of, it kind of follows on what we've talked about so far. But I just want to mention them today because these are the things which are the most common difficulties in helping a person, in allowing a person to be present and be awake and be at ease in the present moment. And we mention them because, so you recognize them, but also mention them so you know that if any of these things arise for you in your meditation practice, it's not that you're failing in your meditation. This is what we expect to arise. This is what happens to human beings, to have these kinds of relationship to experience. And then rather than taking them as distractions, as problems, we take them as actually places where we're trying to wake up and become aware, things we try to investigate and become more familiar with. So what these things are, they're five areas, five responses or relationships based on two experiences when we don't necessarily like what's going on. When we have some difficulty or some suffering or some discomfort in the present moment, we can respond in five different ways. One way is we can have all kinds of sensual desires. Desires for some pleasure, for something better, for a better meditation cushion, or a more comfortable posture, or a better, more comfortable room, or more comfortable, more quiet environment, or maybe a nice beach in Tahiti. You know, we think about all kinds of other things we might want to have to soothe us, to make us feel better, as a kind of compensation for the difficulty. We don't want to look at the difficulty directly, so we start daydreaming about the refrigerator and what's in it. The other response, kind of the opposite of that, is aversion. And we get lost in thoughts and ideas and feelings of ill will, pushing things away. You're not simply thinking, oh, you know, what would be the perfect, you know, meditation cushion to sit in that just fits the contour of my butt just right and just everything's wonderful. But rather you're thinking, I hate this cushion, you know, and I can't wait till I get home and I'm going to burn it. And we're lost in concerns and thoughts and the feelings and emotions of aversion. And different people, you know, have different strategies along. You know, some people have, their common strategy is desire, and that's kind of, it's often more pleasant and more captivating, but there's a lot of energy in aversion too that can grab us, and we can have those different personality types. And then there's another reaction is when things aren't going our way, we're not quite comfortable or happy with it, is we get discouraged or depressed. And so our energy drops and we're reluctant to apply ourselves. We're kind of like we pout and we're kind of like a five-year-old and I'm not going to do this, or I give up, or this is too difficult, or, you know, the energy just kind of drops. And the mind seems kind of heavy and dull and tired and nothing seems to work, and kind of the body doesn't have enough energy to practice. The fourth strategy is, or relationship, is to get restless. You're there for it, you're present for it, but you're just restless and fidgety, and you're not going to stay present, you can't really connect to anything, you're just restless and anxious and whatever. And the fifth strategy of relationship is doubt, is to have all kinds of doubts about what's going on. I can't do this, you know, I'm not good enough for this, or I can't figure it out, or maybe this meditation practice is the wrong one for me. Maybe it's not right, or maybe it is. I don't really know. I have some doubts. Maybe this teacher, you know, who's he after all? He doesn't know anything, probably. And so it's a teacher's problem, and maybe I should find another teacher, a better one, or whatever. Doubts. And so these are kind of relationships that we have with what's going on, places where we get stuck. And I tend to call these hindrances the black holes of awareness, the places where awareness gets sucked up. And a black hole is a place where light goes in and the gravitational force is so strong that the light doesn't come out. So the light of awareness goes in to sensual desire and it doesn't come out. We get lost in it. The problem is not in the desire or the aversion. The problem is that we get lost in it. So learning to become very familiar with this is really the work, a very important area of meditation. So if these things arise in your practice and they're strong, don't get discouraged. Feel that this is really where you're honing and developing your skills as a meditator, to learn to become familiar with these. And it's very useful to do that because they're just as familiar in regular life as they are in meditation. Meditation is really a microcosm of what happens in our normal relationships to life all around us. So becoming aware of our relationships in meditation, what's happening here and now, it becomes a great help in becoming more sensitive to the same phenomena happening in a normal life. So, Brigitte will go into more detail in 2 weeks around the hindrances. But what is our relationship? Is it one of open-heartedness, of generosity, or is it one of clinging, of greed? Is it one of friendliness and love, or is it one of hate or aversion? What is the relationship? Is it open? Is it allowing? Or is it non-accepting? How is it right now? Not to judge that. Just simply, oh, this is what's going on. Remember, the knowing doesn't judge. And what we're doing is we're resting in the knowing. Does that make sense? Maybe you never heard anybody talk that kind of funny way. But this is what we do. Is anybody not to understand? It's fine not to understand. There was a time when I probably wouldn't have understood all this. Sorry?
I kind of understand that.
Kind of. That's a pretty good answer.
it's like doing yoga. It's not that I can be in a position or can't do it. I just can do it the way I do it. I keep doing it. Each time I do it, a little further stretch.
Sounds good to me. So the relationship to experience is important to what's going on. Because it's the relationship where we often suffer. And the idea in meditation is not to suffer, but rather to be happy and be at ease and develop a fundamental kind of trust for ourselves in our life. There are times when you feel frustration in your meditation. Frustration itself is often a cue, a warning that there's some relationship to the present moment which you're not fully aware of, not paying attention to. And so you might kind of back off a little bit and take kind of a wider look around what's happening in the present moment and see, is there something you're missing here? Is there a relationship you're missing or something you're not paying attention to carefully? Sometimes it's the frustration itself. And if the frustration itself is the problem, then we turn back and we bring our full attention to the frustration. See, what often happens in meditation is we often leave something outside of what is we think we're supposed to pay attention to. So, for example, we think that evaluating our meditation moment by moment, blow by blow, that's outside. That's not meditation, right? So that can go on kind of out here. You know, this is really great, and I'm doing really good, and I can't wait to tell everyone, and oh, this is a disaster, and I'm failing at this, and this is terrible, and I wish I had a better breath, and you know, whatever. And all this is going on, right? This commentary. We don't leave anything outside. We bring our attention to that phenomena if that's going really strong. So there's nothing outside. There's only we bring the knowing. And the knowing encompasses everything. And the knowing is freedom. The knowing is, in a way, your ability to know, the sense of knowing, the knowing itself is infinite. When we cling and identify to things, we identify, well, this is me. You know, if my body is me, that's one way to have a relationship, is we think this is me. So if my body is me, then we're completely preoccupied by our wrinkles or completely preoccupied by our, you know, the kind of color hair we have or the kind of mustache we have or the kind of, you know, we spend most of the Saturday afternoon at the cosmetic center at Macy's or in the local gym. And because we think some way or other, we think that really what's important is how we present ourselves to the world, is who I am, is my body, and how I appear. What was that? Sounds so close. Or we identify with our emotions, and we think our emotions are who we are. And so they're really consequential. And when we identify with things, whatever it is, we limit our awareness. We limit ourselves. We no longer identify the body, our feelings, our thoughts, our stories, our history as ourselves. That gives our awareness a chance to become free. And if it becomes free, it becomes infinite. So self-identity limits us. And awareness becomes infinite. So anyway, that's kind of religious language. So I hope that, you know, it's okay.
Awareness something like when you start the piano and you're learning to play note by note, or is awareness perfect from the beginning but we haven't used it?
Awareness is perfect from the beginning. And we are using it, but we don't know it.
When you say that the frustration is key, that there's something without knowing, can you say more about that or give me an example?
Well, the example that I've used is for example, you're following the breath, and really what's going on is your knee hurts, but you're trying to stay with your breath. But there's a tension then between your knee that wants your attention and your effort to be with the breath. And so there's frustration, that tension is kind of frustration. So then you say, well, what's really going on here? So what's really going on is the knee is burning. And as long as you're trying to keep that, those two, you know, trying to do something different than the knee meditation, you're asking for frustration, for difficulty. So you let go of the breath and you just go to tend to the knee, and you're no longer frustrated. Unless, of course, you hate the knee burning. And if you're trying to stay with the physical sensations of the knee, and really what's going on is you're hating it, and that's really powerful, then you might be frustrated again because something else is really asking for your attention. So then you need to back off and say, what's going on here? Oh, it's my relationship, it's the hate. And then you feel the hate, and you notice that, and be present for that. Does that make sense? Yes?
Are you saying then that the awareness is who we really are, and therefore our real self is awareness?
No. if we have that stance, that the awareness is ourself, we've limited it already.
But not a self like a finite self.
Well, you can say it if you want. But you can't say it. I mean, it's kind of like trying to touch your knee. You take your right hand and you try to touch your elbow. You can't, right? So you can't, you know.
You really can't say anything about it.
I've been saying something all the evening. But there is this wonderful thing where, I don't know what to say. Maybe I can't say anything about it. But it doesn't survive very well in self-reflection. It allows for it. There's a way you can do it. It's okay. But it doesn't allow for it too easily. So as soon as you reflect back on it, to think about it, it's lost. And identification is one way we do that. So it's very difficult because most people find their security and happiness and well-being in life through holding on to something, through some experience or some way of being, some understanding or some position or something. And that's already a step of reflection. So it's kind of like playing maybe piano or something, you know, or there's lots of activities we know that we do. But once you become skilled at it, you have to let go of any kind of self-reflection or self-identification. If you're sitting here thinking, I'm a good pianist, you know, you stumble over your fingers. You have to let go of that kind of reflection. So it's kind of like that's taking that to a higher level, in a sense, perhaps, with the practice itself. And it involves, I like the word trust a lot, because maybe that's an issue for me. But it involves, you can say it's a fundamental trust in life itself. But it's a kind of trust where you're no longer trusting. So you don't need it anymore.
Is it helpful to look at this mindfulness like we're so dependent on our eyes, those of us that are blessed with the eyes, and we look at the eyes as the way we see things?
Yes.
So would it be helpful when we come to meditation to look at this mindfulness quality as looking to realize, to see our life now, or see our experience?
Often people use the analogy or the metaphor of eyes. A sage is a seer, and we watch our breath, we say. And I tend to shy away from the language because it tends to set up a kind of dualism between the watcher and the watched. So I tend to try to prefer to use the word like sensing and feeling and experiencing, which is a little bit less dualistic for many people. But it is a classic language, spiritual language, you know, of seeing. But the example, for example, if you're looking out into the room, What is your eyes' experience of themselves? What are your eyes' experience of themselves? Or how do the eyes see themselves when you're looking out into the room? So where are the eyes?
Just seeing.
And so does it even make sense to talk about where they are? I mean, if all of us know they're here, right? But in the moment of the seeing, is there anything behind them? What's behind your eyes when you're looking? Space? Infinite space? You know, what is it? I mean, you can't even say it, right? Is this making any sense to people? Anyway, so there is nothing there. But there's everything there. Also, I mean, there's tremendous dynamic working of life and thoughts and feelings and ideas somehow happen in the midst of this wonderful, fantastic nothing. Isn't that really phenomenal? And most, 99.999% of our life happens by itself. Maybe more than that, probably, right? I mean, you know, the heart works and the neurobiology works and the hormones work and our digestion works and, you know, the balance of all the chemicals in our bloodstream works. Without, for most of it, 99.9999999% happens without our thinking about it and wondering about it and adjusting and fixing it and whatever. And we suffer and get completely, you know, uptight about that little 0.00000001% what we have something to do about. And the illusion that a lot of us live in some sense, is that we have to be more in control of it all than we realize. And a lot of it's possible to trust more of it and relax. And much more will take care of itself beautifully if we're not manipulating and holding on and identifying and trying to make it different and not accepting things or, you know, trying to make things different than the way they are. And, you know. Isn't it a relief? Yes.
Is what you're describing related to the idea of inherent existence?
We don't allow for that in Buddhism.
Right.
That's a heresy in Buddhism. So why do you want to learn the heresy?
I'm just wondering what that concept, how that relates to what you're describing of finding yourself as.
The idea of inherent existence is the idea that there is something that is permanent, everlasting, and inherently exists in and of itself. It's always existed, it will always exist. And so, for example, the soul is such an idea in some traditions, or something like the soul. And the idea in Buddhism is that nothing has that kind of independent existence, that it always exists independent of anything else, that everything exists independent on everything else, or on other things. So things are, rather than being inherently existing, things are dependently existing, is the Buddhist position. And things are interdependent. Interdependently they arise. And so, for example, and this is part of what we learn through meditation, is we start learning the relationships and the connections between things, the causal connections. So we feel, for example, we discover, for example, that, the ice cream truck goes out by outside. And so you hear the ice cream truck, and the next thing you know, there's a memory of this wonderful coffee ice cream you had 2 weeks ago. And the delight of feeling that coffee ice cream. And you see the connection between hearing that and then having those thoughts, because you weren't having those thoughts before the ice cream truck went by. But then you see that you start salivating. And you start seeing there's this kind of wonderful salivation, and a desire arises, and you see this desire arises in your body, this movement in the impulse in the body for going and getting ice cream. And then you see that you're sitting and meditating, so you're not supposed to get up. And then you feel frustrated, and you start feeling restless, and your body feels restless. And then because you're following your breath, you feel your breath is getting constricted and kind of tight, you know, with open and relaxed beforehand. And then you say, well, I better kind of really be present and sense and feel this desire strongly. So you feel the desire, maybe as a kind of emptiness in your pit of your stomach. And so you feel the emptiness for a while, and you feel it, and feeling it, you're no longer caught by it, by that desire. And so suddenly you feel after a while your breath begins to come softer and relaxed again, and you become, the restlessness goes away, and you're calmer. And after a while you notice you're no longer thinking or concerned about ice cream. All those things happen in relationship to each other. None of that happened independently of anything else. You're causally conditioned. You see the relationship between the mind and thoughts and what happens in the body, what happens in the body and what happens with thoughts and ideas. We see what the relationship is when we drive our car twice the speed limit all the time. And when we don't do that, we notice that when we arrive at our destination, we're usually somewhat frazzled when we drive really fast. Even though there's some thrill there, there's some cost. We notice the relationship, the cause and effect relationship with things. That becomes very, very important for Buddhism, for Buddhists. And it's understanding the causal relationships, how things are dependent and arise and are conditioned on each other, that gives us the information of how to make decisions about how to live our life. Because in Buddhism, there's no God or no absolutely existing truth about how we should live our life. You know, it tells us, you know, commandments. That really the person, the only person who can decide, make decisions for ourselves and how to live our life is from inside of ourselves, is our own understanding. And a lot of that comes from understanding consequences and causes and conditions. Because everything arises in dependence on everything else. So one of the places where people get caught around inherent existence is some notion of self, of me, of I. And now most people aren't philosophers going around and kind of saying, well, you know, inherent existence and, you know, permanent idea. But the way they behave kind of psychologically is as if, it's kind of the supposition, the assumption, the premise underneath it all, is as if this is permanent. You know, I'm depressed. You know, and oh my God, you know, this is significant and upset and it's terrible. And we act as if it's permanent and absolute and entity in its own right. And we don't see it comes together out of causes and conditions. And so we get upset about it. We get depressed. We get upset. We get all kinds of things happen. When we see that it arises out of causes and conditions, we don't identify it being me so strongly, or not at all. And then we can be much more at ease with that experience. So we forget, you know, that I'm depressed today for this hour, but yesterday and the day before I wasn't depressed. And it was a week ago I remember being depressed, but that lasted for 5 minutes or an hour or whatever. But we make it into the big drama. Or some people are depressed because it's physiological. You know, they have some kind of biochemical imbalance within them. And it does still seem to last for a long time. I've known a lot of people, it was a great relief to realize that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, they didn't have to identify with that. They weren't responsible for it. But rather it was the causes and conditions of their body that came together to create this kind of physiological event. And so, oh, it's causes and conditions. I don't have to feel responsible. You know, I'm not a terrible person or a bad person or whatever. So this idea of inherent existence is a thing that many of us get caught in, even though we're not philosophers. Because we take it as being solid, as being substantial, as being permanent in the way we relate to it. Rather than investigating and seeing, oh, it arises out of causes and conditions. Is this too much religion and philosophy today?
Corollary is also true. That the great amount of happiness and joy and wonderfulness of life is causes and conditions and really don't expect it to be there all the time.
Exactly, same thing. So what we're trying to develop in mindfulness is to be at ease with all the changes. That's why the knowing is so important, because the knowing is at ease with all the changes.
This too shall pass.
This too shall pass. There was a Sufi, right? Did I tell you a story? This Sufi student who went to his teacher and said, I got this new ring. Can you inscribe some wisdom on it so that it helps me get enlightened or whatever? And so he wrote on the ring, this too shall pass. So he would look at it, this too shall pass. And, you know, it's fine for you to hear that message when you're suffering, right? But you want to hear that message when, you know, you're having a good time.
There would be... from what you said earlier about the two principal ways of meditating on death, on impermanence, and in loving kindness. And it would seem to be the latter with which you embrace everything would not only take care of the ups and downs and the five hindrances, but indeed everything else. If you embrace change itself as with loving kindness, and have that feeling, although one shouldn't get attached to that feeling, as I understand it, but nevertheless approach life that way.
It's very nice, yeah.
That would seem to be the solution, perhaps a temporary one.
Well, it's sure. I mean, what's the solution? Is there a solution? Is there a solution to life? loving kindness is a great way to be in the world, but loving kindness itself arises out of causes and conditions, and is itself will always be temporary. You can't expect to have permanent state of loving kindness, so it itself is not reliable as a solution. It's a great strategy. It's a great way we teach it. It's a powerful practice, and it's very useful. And I encourage you to do it. But you can't rely on it for the solution, because it'll arise and pass like everything else.
You say?
I saw Genevieve's hand.
I'm still struggling with the question of that journey about are we awareness, and a response to that. And it seems to me that on some level, awareness is the type of a guide, it's the type of a deepening process so that we are, on some level, more ourselves as we become more aware. And the practice encourages that and leads us to that. And we may not be pure awareness, but I think the longer I work with this practice, I am more and more aware, not in a way that is reflective necessarily or caught up in thought, but just more aware moment by moment of what's coming up and what's going away and what's coming up and what's going away. And it's an important part of it.
And what happens eventually, though, is that you realize that awareness itself is arising and passing with everything else. And the idea of the awareness being kind of this great field that's kind of permanent, everything kind of coming through, that itself is this kind of temporary sense. And eventually realize that also arises, everything's rising and passing. So, I mean, it's fine to say if you want that the self is, you know, awareness is a self, but there's no reason to do that. There's no reason, why bother? Chances are if you do it, you'll get in trouble.
Just a quick comment. The philosophical bent of the discussion tonight is pretty meaningful to me in the sense of for many of us, intellectual things are something we grasp onto. And I think particularly in Palo Alto, there's probably like more than the average number of people like that. And in a lot of what being intellectual about is making points in conversation or trying to come up with the grand idea that everybody go, or just the right phraseology. And I find when I meditate now that sometimes that's where my mind's going. Suddenly, the insight I'm getting is just the clever way of putting a few words together. And the better thing I find happening is realizing that the insight that I find more satisfying is that direct knowing of actually learning something and not worrying about how to express it, but getting the message.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you. The subject for tonight, the main subject, was going to be in some ways more mundane, was about the integration of the practice of mindfulness into daily life. Because in a sense, primarily what I've been teaching you is in the auspices, the idea of sitting meditation. But mindfulness practice is not something that's only limited to sitting meditation, but it's something that applies equally well to daily life. And the distinction between the mind, the heart, the body in meditation and outside meditation is arbitrary. And sometimes beginning meditators often will feel like, oh, this is a really special event. You know, meditation is very different from a normal life. But actually, as you deepen your practice, you realize you can't maintain that distinction. And then the interest arises is how to bring this into a normal life. How to make it life seamless, in a sense, so that the integrity, the wholeness, the ease of meditation, the trust, the presence, the connection, the intimacy that comes through meditation, how can all that be also in my daily life? So some people, that arises with time as they meditate, that desire to bring it into their life. Some people have a much more pragmatic bent to begin with, and they say, well, meditation's fine, but I want it to help my life. And then how is this, you know, and so tell me how to apply it to my life right away. Both are beautiful movements. And the idea is basically to do the same thing in daily life. Pay attention. It's just very simple. You pay attention. What's going on right now? What's happening right now? Take an interest in paying attention to what's happening in the present moment. What's happening in your body? The body is a great guide in daily life for being present to what's happening. The guide will tell you, the body will tell you, it's like an antenna. It'll tell you a phenomenal amount of what's going on. How you respond, how you feel, the posture you take. Being aware of your emotions as you go along. There's so many subtle emotions that go unnoticed in our life. And you can do an exercise, which I recommend, is when you're driving, for example. Start noticing the kaleidoscope of subtle emotions. See how subtle you can get, and see how quickly they shift and change, depending on what kind of car is next to you, in front of you, behind you, or, you know, all this stuff, and you know, that's a nice car, you know, and then suddenly desire arises, and then, oh, that's a jerk, oh, and then, oh, there's a cop car, and a little bit of fear, and, oh, he went away, and that's a little bit of relief, and then, you know, and it can be very, very subtle, but you notice how subtle it can be, and make it an exercise, because what happens if you notice that, you know, maybe that's happening all the time, and if the gross emotions, maybe if we're lucky, we know them, but if you start realizing how subtle the shifts in the kaleidoscope is all the time, you realize how much goes unnoticed. If you realize how much goes unnoticed, you might realize how much the cumulative effect of conditioning or through the day has on you. So you know, maybe a little ripple of fear, you know, the cop car, a little bit of fear. And then, oh, maybe I'm going to miss my exit, a little bit of fear. Oh, maybe I'm going to, you know, maybe I'm not going to have enough gas, a little bit of fear. You know, the cumulative effect of that, by the end of the day, it might have a big impact. And you might find yourself being very anxious, but in the day, you don't know how you got anxious. Or little movements of aversion, of hate, oh, that jerk, or that, you know. Through the day, you might find yourself getting tense. So just checking in, being aware of what's happening in the moment is very helpful. The practice of mindfulness, often enough, is said to be very simple. It's just paying attention. What's considered to be difficult is remembering to do it. And so learning how to do that in daily life is an art, is a skill, is a practice we develop through time. There's various ways we can do, various things you can do to help us become more present, more aware in our normal life. One is choose certain activities through the day that you're going to specialize as activities for mindfulness. It could be short things for 5 or 10 minutes, washing dishes, cooking, maybe driving to work or driving home from work, or maybe being in the bathroom and shaving or brushing your teeth or whatever. Certain activities where this is your dedication is not to rush through and get them done as quickly as you can, but really to learn how to be fully mindful for this. Another way of saying this is find certain activities to do where the how you do it becomes more important than the what you're doing. And many of us, I think, focus on the what often to the detriment of the how. And see if you can find a how, a presence of being, an openness, a generosity of being, an ease in being, and rather than, you know, getting it done as quickly, as fast, and efficiently as you can. So if you can choose certain activities, and you might vary them over the week, slowly you'll start developing the habit of bringing more awareness into other aspects of your life. And maybe you'll find it very, very, very deeply satisfying. I hope you do. Some people use cues through the day as reminders or suggestions to wake up, to pay attention to what's going on. Or to just take a few moments, to, you know, take a breather. It's a great term, great expression. Just be with your breath a little bit. Some people take red light, stop signs. as you sit in your car and follow your breath, rather than being anxious about turning green or thinking about tomorrow or planning or whatever. Some people take the phone ringing. They don't answer it right away, but they let it ring for three or four rings. And take those three or four rings as time just to connect to the breath and be in your body and sense, find out how actually you feel, what's going on right now. For a long time, I used to take doorways as being my cues. Because when you're going through a door, you're going into a new space. So whenever I went through a doorway, I try to remember to pay attention, what's going on with me and what's going on around me, to wake up. Another way of bringing the practice into daily life, which is very helpful, very powerful, is do your meditation practice every day. It's very useful to do a practice meditation every day. The benefits really only come, I think, when you really do it every day on a regular basis. Not only that way, but that's a very powerful way. But regardless what happens in your meditation, the tendency for most people is the meditation period ends, and you know, that's it, and you go start your life. You know, and you rush to get your coffee made, and you brush your teeth, and comb your hair, and read the paper all at the same time to get out the door. And you have less time now because now you're meditating in the morning, so you have less time to do anyway, so you have to be even faster. So that's one way of living. The other way, but the other way is to take the time at the end of your meditation as being a continuation of your practice. Because what happens is that, and a lot of the tremendous self-understanding that comes from mindfulness comes from paying attention to what happens as you leave your meditation cushion, leave your meditation session. Because what happens is, to some degree or other, perhaps, you feel a little bit more at ease, a little bit more present, a little more comfortable with yourself, a little bit calmer, perhaps, in your meditation. That's not the definition of successful meditation. But to some degree, that might happen. And because that's happened, you let go of the normal identifications, normal concerns, normal attachments to some degree. As we leave meditation and go back into a normal life, all those things tend to come back. Our self-identity, our stories, our concerns, our worries, the choices we make kind of unconsciously about we have to hurry and do this and that all at once. Why, you know, and behind being hurrying is the evaluation, this is important, and, you know, and my life is not secure unless I do 10 things at once. And what happens is all those things have to be reconstructed in order for us to begin rushing around. So the opportunity exists, if you continue being aware as you leave meditation, to notice how we reconstruct our identity, how we reconstruct our value system, how we reconstruct our projections and ideas of what the reality around us is and what's important. So rather than being unconscious about it or taking it for granted everything, we watch. So for example, you get up from meditation, and you're feeling fine, and then you notice that it's 8:30, and you have to be at work at 9:00. That's fine in itself, but you haven't gotten dressed yet, and there's two ways of getting dressed. There's getting dressed something practical, useful, that's sufficient. Or it's getting dressed in this wonderful, wonderful suit and coat and tie that is, you know, not really necessary. The job doesn't require it. But it kind of presents you as being a good he-man, you know, a good masculine kind of image. So normally you might not notice that moment of choice there between just something practical to wear and the moment of putting on a masculine image. And so you rush in, and it takes a lot longer to put on the masculine image. After all, you have to kind of, you know, trim your mustache just right, and you have to kind of polish those shoes, and the tie's kind of hard, and, you know, and whatever, and you have to iron the shirt, and, you know, and so you had half an hour becomes kind of hectic, all because you were concerned about having a masculine image. Normally, you wouldn't catch that, but because now you're paying attention, you say you catch that moment, and you see the choice there, and if you can see the choice, then there's a possibility of freedom. If you don't see the choice, there's no possibility for freedom, right? Am I making sense to you? I'm kind of making up stories to get a point across. But you probably have your own version, right? So this is a very useful way of learning how to bring the practice into your daily life. it's very useful to get support in mindfulness practice. It's very hard to do it by oneself. And the Buddha said that mindfulness practice was kind of like going against the currents of popular culture. And many people report that as they try to be more present, more calm, more honest, more ethical, more, you know, their value systems kind of change because they're not, you know, dressing up always like a masculine kind of he-guy, but rather just kind of taking the time to be more relaxed, you know, that it goes against some of the popular assumptions and ideas of what we have to be. And it's very hard to do that. And I know, talked to a lot of people who struggle with not only the external ideas of what people are doing and values of society, but how they've internalized those things. So it's very valuable to be around other people who are doing the same thing. So finding a meditation group to sit with, for example, or a group, a discussion group, people to discuss your practice with, is very useful. And we have one here that you're welcome to come to Thursdays and Mondays. There's other meditation groups around that you can go, maybe are more suited for you. There's a Zen Center in Mountain View and you know, different places around. And maybe one's near your home. And it's very useful to sit with other people doing similar things and be supported. To occasionally go longer retreats, to sit for an all-day retreat, for example, can be very helpful to kind of inspire a person, to kind of get a deeper grounding in the practice as a way of going further in the self-inquiry that mindfulness is. Becoming very familiar with the hindrances, because the hindrances arise in daily life. And not condemning them or being upset, but rather not exactly inviting them either, but being quite willing and interested to discover how to be awake and non-judgmental and friendly to even the hindrances and to everything in our life is very helpful in our daily life. So these are just a few things. I could have talked a lot more. So this ends the 5-week course. As I said, in some sense, in the next weeks, we'll just continue it for those of you who want to come. We'll change the schedule. What we'll do is, when we come at 7, I'll say a couple of short words about sitting for people who might be brand new, but only for 2 or 3 minutes. And then we sit in silence for half an hour, and then we have 45 minutes of talk and discussion, and then we end with 15 minutes of sitting again. And the themes over the next weeks will just be kind of, as I said, kind of continuation. Do you have any class questions or concerns or things that are pressing or important? Yes.
It's making me silly again, but in the morning, can you start meditating when you're groggy, or do you have to really be awake first?
You can practice when you're groggy. You can practice meditation at any time. It doesn't require anything except start. And so you do groggy meditation. And then maybe you stay groggy the whole time. Maybe you wake up in the course of it. I'm often a little bit groggy when I sit down to meditate in the morning, and it seems to, you know, passes within some time. What's really phenomenal, I'm still amazed at this. I'm more relaxed after I do my morning meditation than I am after I wake up. You'd think that after a good night's sleep, you're pretty relaxed, but sleep is not as relaxing as meditation. I can feel my body relaxes, and I wake up with tension. It's much less than what I had during the day before, but you wake up with a little tension and whatever, and meditation allows all that to, you know, to have a chance to release. So you can do it anytime, and it's up to you to decide. Do both ways for a while and decide which one you prefer.
I had one more question about that loving kindness meditation. You said it will rise and fall like anything else. But with a bit of effort, one can bring that back. It's not that what one should do, not only in meditation, but else one extends it into the day world?
It depends what you're defining as loving kindness here. You can always bring the practice of it. The practice is based on the intention. Bringing the intention, kind of opening to the intention for your own happiness and for happiness of others. The feelings and emotions that might arise because you're practicing that intention, they come and go. So if you're identifying loving kindness with a feeling of friendliness, of warmth, of love, that'll come and go. And you might not always be successful to bring it up to the feelings, to evoke them.
But I would feel as though then I would make an effort to do that.
And sometimes you'll be able to evoke it, and sometimes you won't. Sometimes you'll get angry instead.
Yes,
true. So, okay, so I hope that these 5 weeks have been useful, and that it has some bearing on your life, and you can apply it both in your meditation life and in your daily life. And it's something that I have tremendous love for, and maybe some of you, as you do it, will also discover this great love of awareness itself, of practice. And I wish you all well, much happiness. Thank you.